All right. Good evening, everybody, and thanks to everyone for coming along from this very early part of the term to have what we hope will be an interesting discussion. Our guest tonight, as you can see here, you can all read, so I don't have to read this all out to you, is Vitor Constancio. My Portuguese pronunciation is lousy, so you'll have to forgive me, Vitor.
No problem.
Who has been there really since the start of the euro. When it started, he was Portugal's, the governor of the Banco de Portugal, and afterwards he became, in 2010, one of the members of the governing council of the executive board of the European Central Bank and subsequently vice president. So he's seen it all. But he has a distinguished back history to that as well that some of you may not be so well aware of. He's been a prominent figure within the Portuguese Socialist Party. He's served on the Council of State, or Conselho de Estado. Sorry, I'm getting there. And many other distinguished posts.
And finance minister.
Oh, yes.
The
finance minister I was going to overlook because of the difficulties that the Portuguese economy got into.
Well, when I was there.
There is, though, one question I simply don't know the answer to yet, and I'm hoping that at some point, Vitor, you will clarify this. Yeah. Benfica or Sporting?
Well, it runs in the family. For a long time, it's Benfica.
There we are.
As far as it goes, you know, but that's so something hereditary.
These are the important things to know about anybody from Portugal, particularly from Lisbon. Now, you can see here that we have a hashtag for those of you who are obsessed with Twitter and want to Twitterize about this. And what we're going to talk about now is how can you strengthen the European Monetary Union? I know that Vitor has very strong views on this. He's articulated them recently in an interview with Der Spiegel, where you said that things can get better. The euro is essential. You don't regret that the European Monetary Union was created. You have, I think, for a central banker, been very moderately critical of the Germans and some of their approaches. So without further ado, would you join me in welcoming Vitor Constancio to give this talk?
Yes. Oh, okay. It's already the outline. Thank you very much, Ian, and thank you very much also for the invitation and to all of you for the interest in European affairs, and in particular to discuss what should be done to strengthen the monetary union and the European project, consequently. It may be a little bit hard, in a way, that we have this discussion for two main reasons. First, because it seems that there is no political will at the moment to do anything significant. That's one reason. And the second is perhaps linked. It's the idea that the situation in the euro area has improved in several ways, as I will illustrate in a moment. And so perhaps that reinforces this trend that governments and authorities feel not pressed to really take some bold decisions, as we have seen in recent results of the summits and the French-German declaration of Meseberg and so on, all that we see there. So, well, nevertheless, being at a university, I think that an academic discussion would be always welcomed in the both senses of the word. But beyond that, I think that there is a false sense of safety in looking to the recent improvements in the situation of the euro area, and that fault lines, shortcomings are still present, and so reforms are needed to build a more secure, solid, and efficient monetary union. So the performance of the monetary union has not been as good as expected by many at the beginning, although some were always conscious that difficulties would emerge because the project risks were enormous, of course, to build a monetary union with so heterogeneous set of countries, and that many changes would have to occur along the way. Nevertheless, indeed, there is this sense that the results have not been as good as expected, even taking into account that we had to face a big international crisis, the big recession, and even with that, there is this sense, perhaps not so much because the average performance of the euro area is so dramatically bad, as I will show in a moment, but because it was very uneven, the distribution of the costs and benefits of what happened. And that is why the crisis of 2011, the double dip of 2012 and 13, the absence of visible convergence of real income among member countries led to some political bitterness and mistrust. And so political risks are, in the present situation, higher than what would be grounded on the economic situation of the euro area. And we have to be aware of that that development since the beginning. Indeed, I will not dwell on this slide for reasons of time, but this bitterness and mistrust relates very much to the evolution of the crisis itself, and there are several narratives about what happened and why. There are two sorts of obsessions of some countries and economists. For instance, U.S. economists in particular tend to focus on a competitiveness story and a balance of payments crisis. It was because there is no longer the exchange rate instrument and there was real appreciation, balance of payments crisis, and that's the main driver. Well, it's not the case in my view. The other obsession, of course, is more happens more in Central Europe. Well, it's a fiscal narrative. It's because of budget deficits that increased in the periphery of the euro area. It's not that either. Indeed, what happened initially was two big financial shocks. The first one was the big drop in interest rates during the 90s, since the beginning of the project, after Maastricht in 92, until 99. Drops in real interest rates in Portugal were 6 percentage points, 6.7 in Spain, 10.4 in Ireland. This was a huge shock coming from that. Is related to the so-called Walter's critique, but it's not exactly the same. And the second shock was, of course, the tsunami of capital inflows that also during the 90s and afterwards increased demand and provoked a demand shock in those countries. For instance, the exposure of banks in central countries to the banks in the periphery countries, in the five countries in the periphery, quintupled from 1999 to 2007 and attained 55% of the GDP of those five countries. So these two huge shocks created a demand shock that led then to overeating, increase in wages and prices that were not an exogenous trigger but were the consequences of that. Then came, not the balance of payments crisis in the full sense, because there was no problem of getting international liquidity to payments, because we were all members of a monetary union, and so the and most of the payments and the deficits were in euros, so there was no problem of international liquidity. And finally, of course, with the banking crisis and the bailouts of banks and the crisis itself affecting the revenues, came then the increase in deficits. The total debt of Spain in 2007 was 36%, of Ireland was 25%, of Portugal was around 65%, even lower in these cases than the average of the time, but after then the crisis itself and the bailout of banks led to the explosion of the then so-called sovereign debt crisis. So that is the narrative. What is more important is that financial markets are the essential thing to think about when we think about developments in the euro area and financial shocks. Indeed, the crisis proves that control of money and inflation is not enough to regulate our economies, that finance and private debt, because it was mostly private debt that increased during that period before the crisis, finance and private debt are at the center of the way our economies work. But as I said, there were improvements. And indeed, if we look to the growth of real GDP per head of population, we see there the double dip of 2012-13, but then after 14, the growth of the average growth of real GDP per head has been the same as in the US, and the projections of the IMF until 2023 provide the same parallel evolution of both. So that's one look. The double dip of 12-13 was one of the big problems that was not related to the single currency itself, but to the policy mistakes that were made at that period. More about that later. And if we look to the cumulative growth of GDP per head in purchasing power standards of the 28 countries, which is PPP in dollars, this is the equivalent, but in reference to the European Union 28 countries, we see that indeed already the core and the euro area as a whole, this cumulative growth was per head was even slightly better than in the US, but the periphery had a totally different development. And convergence among the 12 initial member countries was illustrated here by the coefficient of variation of the GDP per head during these years. We don't see great convergence, even divergence with the increase in the coefficient of variation, although among the 19, the new countries converged very quickly, and so among the 19, there is indeed overall convergence real GDP per head in purchasing power standards. And in terms of levels, not cumulative developments or dispersion indicators, we see here the divergence of the periphery. But more important, perhaps, is to look to this chart, which gives us the GDP per head cumulative growth since 1993. Why picking up so long ago? Because, indeed, the financial shock happened after the Maastricht Treaty, started during the 90s, with the play in the markets that, interest rates came down in all the periphery countries, and the catching up of these countries happened also during that decade. And if you pick since then, you see that the cumulative growth, not the levels, of course, but it's the cumulative growth since 93, this is not very good, but you see the order. The country that increased more was Ireland. It's out of the chart because they went from 100 to 320. And so I didn't put it there. That was absolutely miraculous, what happened with Ireland since 93. But Spain then comes in first with this cumulative growth. Then the core seven countries, and then Portugal up there. Then the average of the euro area, 12 countries. And then we see what happened to Italy and Greece. The big drop in Greece, which was a real tragedy, in terms of this indicator, 40% decline in terms of GDP, almost 30%. And Italy also did not perform well at all. And it's there, and both countries still below what was the cumulative growth in 2007. So these are important things to retain because they explain some of the tensions in the euro area. Nevertheless, it's important to highlight that the more recent Eurobarometer survey in all member countries shows that in Ireland, 86% of the population is in favor of the euro area. In Portugal, 80%. In Spain, 76%. In Greece, 69%. And in Italy, 61%. And that's the more recent results, which show an increase in spite of what has happened. So it's important also to retain this result, because it shows that for many reasons, most Europeans in the euro area, the overall average, by the way, is 74 in favor of the euro area, are indeed attached to the single currency and don't want to go back. The more recent improvements are shown in a cyclical convergence, taking only the growth rates, not the cumulative rates, but the more recent growth rates. We see that the dispersion of real GDP growth in the euro area as a whole, it's at the same level of the G7 dispersion, and it has converged, so the standard deviation weighted came down, and the real growth rates in the more recent years between the periphery and the core are practically the same. So there is cyclical convergence. All countries are growing and are growing at, say, similar rates, or at least with a dispersion that it's not significant. And it's better, that dispersion, that what happened since the beginning of the euro area in 99. So these are significant results. Also, in this chart, I illustrate, taking it from the one of the latest economic bulletins of the ECB, that the synchronization of the economic cycle has improved in the euro area. This blue line here is for the euro area, and it shows the common factor behind the growth rate of the euro area, and the common factor has increased in the more since 2014 precisely, and it's now higher than at the beginning. And of course, during the period of the crisis, the common factor was very common and explained everything, because all countries were having a recession. But this improvement also shows that there is more synchronization of the cycles. I skipped that chart, which is from the more recent paper by Eiken Green and Bayoumi, showing that calculating the correlation between demand and supply shocks among the different countries, the core countries have changed from what they were in 92 when they had the first version of that paper, and what they did last year, where the core countries were now different in the core of the euro area. And for instance, Portugal, Italy are now in that core according to that methodology, which has problems. Confirming this idea of better synchronization of the economic cycles. And this has happened in spite of the competitiveness story, the importance of the exchange rate. I have to be very quick on this for reasons of time, but I wanted to criticize this obsession that everything is about the exchange rate, and that if some countries would have, again, their own currency and their own exchange rate, they would solve their problems. Well, the exchange rate effectiveness has decreased over time. The pass-through of inflation to import prices, and even more so to inflation, is declining. An ECB paper of last year shows that, indeed, it's almost zero, the pass-through to inflation of movements in the exchange rate. And as we see there, the export shares of several European countries declined, mostly because, of course, the share of China and other emerging countries increased very much. But in spite of that, the export shares of Spain, of Portugal, of Greece stay very stable in spite of the movements in the exchange rate. And the growth rates of real exports put Portugal and Spain since 1999, the cumulative growth shows a performance that one would not expect if the exchange rate would have such an importance. So as I said, I will skip these slides. This is from a significant working paper of the ECB of last year, trying to explain the drivers of the export shares of the in the euro area. And as we see there, they analyze 42 possible variables. They apply a Bayesian model averaging methodology to select variables and models. And considering country fixed effects in that sample, they then find that the importance of the real exchange rate is indeed very small and not significant, because the ratio of the mean over the standard deviation is below 2. So I wanted to highlight that because the temptation of some countries or some analysts and economists saying that they would be better off if they had their own currency is indeed not justified. And not even thinking about what they would have to face with weak currencies after they would leave, with all the financial losses that that would entail. So let's, and then the idea also that the problems, or at least most of the problems that we have had, are not directly related to the fact that we created a single currency, but with the shortcomings of the initial design of monetary union and policy mistakes. Briefly, the three main design shortcomings were, in my view, first, the absence of any mechanism to respond to acute liquidity squeezes and sudden stops in the sovereign bond market, linked with the demotion of national public debts with higher default risks. There is a typo here. The second shortcoming was that the framework did not include a macro stabilization function to deal with asymmetric and symmetric significant recessionary shocks. And the third was that the economic and financial integration was not, which was huge and very quick with all the effects that I mentioned before, was not accompanied by any sort of European-level supervision of the financial system. These huge capital inflows should not have happened if there had been, at the time, proper pan-European supervision over the banking sectors of the whole countries. Banking union came much later. The crisis, of course, was aggravated by some policy mistakes that now, with insight, become much more clear. And some of the critics, of course, exaggerate the criticism, ignoring that in real time things are always more difficult to judge, to decide, to assess, and to make decisions. Nevertheless, now, with the benefits of hindsight, we can say, and I can say, that these are, I think, the more important points to discuss related to mistakes. The first one was the excessive adjustment effort demanded from Greece, which generated the GDP collapse that was well beyond the forecasts of the time, so no one planned for a program that would lead to such a drop in GDP in Greece, but it happened, so there were mistakes. The excessive general fiscal consolidation that mostly explains the double dip in 2012 and 13. There is a working paper of the Commission that used their Quest model to simulate the effect of all the countries at the same time during those 3 years making fiscal consolidation. And they find in that working paper that these general coordinated fiscal consolidation led to a deviation from the baseline scenario of GDP growth of 8 percentage points in Germany, 18 in Greece, 15 in Portugal, 10 in Spain. So the double dip is mostly explained by the fiscal consolidation of those years. And that was something that it was not necessary that it should happen and should not have happened in that way at the time. Third, the protracted process of Greek debt restructuring, which started with Deauville in 2010. Then in July 2011, there was the first decision and announcement by the ECOFIN about what would be that that restructuring. And then it was not approved and implemented at that time. The thing lingered for several reasons I don't have time to go into. And finally, it was only concluded in February, March of 2012. This issue of the debt restructuring for Greece is a major point of contention and discussion among economists. For instance, Ashoka Mordi, in his recent book, The Euro Tragedy, makes a lot of the point that this process of debt restructuring was not responsible for any turbulence in the euro area. That turbulence was because of the increases in interest rates in 2011 by the ECB. That the debt restructuring in Greece should have happened already in 2010. And things would have been different. Other economists make the same point, which is easier to make a posteriori. It's not, nevertheless, documented, well documented, that all this discussion about haircuts and debt restructure in Greece had no consequences in the turbulence of 2011. There was huge consequences. In a speech in 2012, I disclosed some internal work of the ECB showing precisely that what happened with Greece had a huge contagion impact in the spreads and CDS premia of other several countries, going a little bit to France. So there was indeed significant contagion at the period, and that turbulence was in real time more important than the increases of interest rate of the ECB in 2011, which, as I say, with insight, it's easier to criticize. But at the time when they were made, inflation was 2.7, and growth in Europe in the first half of 2011 was 2%. So it seemed more justified in real time, but it was not, because then in the second half of that year, the economy decelerated very sharply, and we corrected those increases in November and December and eliminated them. But this is a point of great contention about the interpretation of the developments. And then we can say that the decisions of increases in interest rates in 2008 and 11, although they were quickly corrected, are indeed within sight, and the first one not even within sight, in my view, in real time too, were controversial. And the OMT decision of July 2012 put a stop to the euro existential crisis, but there was a delayed use of QE, which made monetary policy less expansionary during a number of years than it should have been in view of developments of inflation. But the point is also true that the forecasts of the time of all institutions missed both the seriousness of the double dip and the protracted period of very low inflation. In real time, it was more difficult. So now, with this background, what are possible approaches to necessary reforms to address those shortcomings and possibly also avoid policy mistakes in the future? There are many proposals, dozens, so it's enormous literature, as one could expect. Let me try to summarize some of them. Well, a definitive solution would be to go for more political union, and along the way have euro bonds with the mutualization, with joint liability of member countries, and fiscal union in the end with full centralized budget policy and so on. That would put, indeed, a stop to the first shortcoming I mentioned and would change completely the redomination risk within the euro area. But it's unrealistic, of course, to expect that this may happen anytime soon, because it involves a high degree of political union. So another approach by Barry Eichengreen, and both Paul de Grau and Eichengreen in the colloquium that the ECB organized for my farewell, for my departure, presented their views. And Eichengreen and this set of proposals. First, establishing a normal central bank, as he put it, meaning a central bank able to pursue flexible inflation targeting and able to backstop banking systems and markets in government bonds. Second, completing the banking union. Third, renationalizing fiscal policy and making the right kind of progress on political union. Why item C? Well, the idea that it's very difficult to implement and achieve compliance with the Stability Pact, so perhaps it's easier to renationalize fiscal policy and give responsibility to member states. And his argument is based on the idea, first, that fiscal spillovers from one country to others are not very significant in the euro area, and indeed, I quote there, a working paper of the ECB of last year showing that indeed those spillovers are very small. And so if they are very small, then makes less important to have the Stability Pact. And, of course, renationalizing fiscal policy would have to be accompanied by a credible non-bailout clause, and to make it credible, that would imply a credible threat of debt restructuring, which makes, of course, this renationalization of fiscal policy, as he says, an impossibility theorem, because to have both at the same time the renationalization of fiscal policy with all the fears in Central Europe and obsession that everything is due to fiscal policy misbehavior, and on the other hand, the debt restructuring threat, which then is refused by the more the weaker countries. So, indeed, I allude to this in my farewell speech, saying that it is doubtful, indeed, that member countries would be willing to try this Faustian pact between a debt reduction and sovereign debt restructuring mechanism. Well, these views, nevertheless, deserve, I think, a deeper discussion. But the underlying idea, one of the underlying ideas, which also Martin Sandbu from the Financial Times expresses several times in his columns, is the idea that it is enough to stabilize the banking sector, and you don't need the common rules on fiscal policy, because then the private sector will self-equilibrate, which the crisis show it's not the case. So this is certainly a matter for discussion. But it's important to retain that these sort of thoughts and ideas are out there. Then there is the CEPR policy insight 91 document by 14 French and German economists that try, but in my view fail, to present a balanced proposals of market discipline on one side and risk sharing on the other hand. Well, the first for them include significant concentration capital charges to push for a reduction of banks' holdings of domestic sovereign debt, meaning that when a bank would have in its portfolio a percentage of domestic debt above a certain threshold, which they put quite low, would have then capital surcharges as a result, trying to push the banks to diversify. The second market discipline proposal is to strengthening the institutional and legal underpinnings of sovereign debt restructuring. They don't go as far as proposing automatic debt restructuring after a certain threshold of the debt ratio is attained, but they push in that direction. And the third idea of market discipline is a new fiscal rule based on expenditure, an expenditure-based fiscal rule with junior bonds issuance, meaning subordinated junior bonds, bound more easily to have haircuts, to fund the excess expenditure when countries would not comply with the expenditure rule. And items A and B can be destabilizing. Indeed, the idea of concentration capital charges and the idea that this doom loop, the fact that the banks in several countries in the periphery have high percentages in their portfolio of domestic sovereign bonds is a big risk. It's a controversial one. It would be better if those banks would have a more diversified portfolio. That is easy to agree. But to use this method, or even worse, putting quantitative limits, as also some German economists proposed, on these portfolios would be destabilizing, potentially, because some countries, and Italy is the case, have every year to roll over hundreds of billions of their debt every year. And of course, to have this rollover not disturbed by these heavy costs on the banks would potentially create destabilization risks in the national debt market, because the easiest way to roll over is for the holders that have the debt to buy new debt and to roll it over. It's more difficult to have to find new buyers from one year to the next. So caution is required. And then there are other arguments. There is a working paper that I quote in that my farewell speech, showing that if there would be such a diversification of portfolios, it means that in other countries, for having the diversification, they would have to increase debt of weaker countries. So, and analyzing the whole situation of the all banking sectors and the cross-border network effects, that working paper simulating several combinations of these effects concludes that overall the risk of for banks in the euro area as a result of that diversification that is aimed at would not be significant, neither for the whole nor for the countries individually. And it's also true, of course, that indeed the situation of the sovereign can affect the banks, but it can be shown that when a sovereign collapses, that affects the banks, but also the non-financial firms, which can be seen in the CDS market premia, and more so the banks. Even if they would not have a big portfolio of domestic sovereign debt, they would suffer from the collapse of the sovereign. So if the macro channel, the macroeconomic channel, would always be there. So my solution to this issue is the only solution to diversify without destabilizing effects is to create an European safe asset. And then the banks could indeed diversify without the same risks. More about that in a moment. The risk-sharing part of the proposals of these 14 economists is to have the European Deposit Insurance Scheme, yes, but with permanent national compartments and only after risk reduction of several types. So it's indeed a limited European Deposit Insurance Scheme. And they also propose a very small stabilization fund linked to unemployment. When I say small, it's because the contribution annually would be 0.1% of GDP by each country, and only when a country would have an unemployment rate 3 percentage points above the threshold would the country get 0.25% of its GDP as support from this fund. It's indeed very small. Other German economists, and Lars Feld, I quote here because he was supposed to be the 15th member of that paper, he dropped because of the stabilization fund, in spite of being small, because what he favors is that that is not necessary, EDIS is also not necessary. What would, he considers is to have an upfront debt relief to reduce the debt overhang of the more indebted countries and then apply harsher fiscal rules and a debt restructuring mechanism after that debt relief. So, considering all this, my priorities would be the following. First, the more important problem is the question of financial markets and to address the problem of the sovereign debt market fragility in a monetary union, possibility of liquidity squeezes, sudden stops that no one had predicted could happen in the European Monetary Union, and redenomination risk. The second would be completing the banking union and the situation of remaining weak banks. Third would be the European stabilization function to address both symmetric and asymmetric shocks, and then other reforms are also very useful, not as urgent or important as the first three in my view, but nevertheless very useful, would be a review of the Stability Pact and the effective creation of a capital markets union. Very briefly, so regarding the first problem, excluding Eurobonds and fiscal union, then what we have is then the recognition that the instrument of ECB purchase of government bonds is legal, as the European Court of Justice has decided, already, and that should be used whenever, or similar instruments. There were other proposals, but indeed the central bank would have to be involved whenever necessary to avoid self-fulfilling liquidity crises in sovereign bond markets unjustified by fundamentals, which is the rationale and approach of the alt-right monetary transactions program decided in 2012. Second, the ESM, the European Stabilization Mechanism, should have higher financial capacity, not just the 500 billion that it has, but perhaps the double, through leveraging the capital they have. And third, it would be useful clarification that leaving the euro implies triggering Article 50 to leave the EU altogether. That is not explicit in the treaty, but indeed, for members of the European Union, it is a treaty obligation to have the euro, except when they have negotiated an opting clause, an opting out clause, as the UK and Denmark negotiated, or when the countries are not complying with the criteria to enter the monetary union. So rather than that, there is that obligation of having the euro as their currency. So if they would leave, the logical would imply that they should leave the EU altogether, and that would help a little bit, but perhaps significantly, to mitigate predenomination and risk every time a country is under some pressure from markets. The second priority is banking union. I already talked about the diversification of bank sovereign portfolios, creation of the European Deposit Guarantee Scheme, the Single Resolution Fund with its fiscal backstop. So debt completion is very important because it's a way of having a financial architecture that can respond and make safe the banking sectors of the monetary union. Third would be a stabilization function, which would have to be more significant than the one proposed by the 14 French and German economists. And I agree basically with the proposal presented by the IMF in a recent discussion paper, which would imply an annual contribution of 0.35% of GDP of each country, and then would also use the unemployment rate as the trigger for payments to countries where unemployment would go above a historical moving average of unemployment in that country. And in that case, a 1% only, 1 percentage point above that moving threshold would entail a transfer, a payment of 0.5% of GDP of that country. And that would be, and the IMF paper makes historical simulations to show, that this would have a significant effect when this would have been applied in the past. So this type of rainy day fund would be what is needed. What is now on the table are things that are much smaller. It's a budget line for the euro area for investment in innovation, and a small one, and a possible existence of liquidity support for unemployment subsidies in member countries if they would have a liquidity problem, and that's not the issue, of course. But then would be loans to the national insurance, unemployment insurance schemes. And even that is not not approved and not a guarantee at all that it will happen. Finally, stability pact review. Well, the stability pact as it exists is a real nightmare of complexity. There are at least four rules in the stability pact. A country has to have a deficit below 3% of GDP, but that's not the whole thing. The second thing, it has to have a structural deficit corrected from the cycle, going to a medium-term objective of that structural deficit adjusted to the cycle, and if it is below that objective, it has to move to that objective by 0.5% each year. That's the second rule. And the third rule is that if it has a debt ratio above 60%, it has to reduce that debt ratio by 1 over 20 times of the difference to 60% every year. And that's the third rule. And there is a fourth one about expenditure, saying that when a country has a debt above 60 and it's not in its MTO, medium-term objective, then expenditure must increase the same as or less than the increase of potential nominal GDP. So, four rules and a host of many other things. So, it's really very complex. So, the idea of moving with the proper transition to a simple expenditure rule that along the lines of the recent French proposal published by the French Conseil d'Analyse Économique would be, in my view, a good simplification. And what they propose is that there would be an expenditure path which would be calculated to attain a certain objective of the debt ratio, not necessarily 60%. Yeah, I have to finish. I'm sorry. So that would be my approach. And finally, and that's the last slide, creation of a genuine capital markets union. There is this program, but indeed it has not been taken very seriously, the initiatives that have been proposed and approved are marginal to the core of such a objective, which would be important now that the countries have the same currency to have a fully integrated capital market that would spur innovation and enable the development of an efficient venture capital market. This requires a lot of things that are difficult, of course, but that's the way to have it in the end. And at the center of those requirements is, of course, the creation of a European safe asset. Not Eurobonds, but a synthetic product, that's one version, based on the national debts. So the issuance of that synthetic product would create demand for the national debts. But for in the proposal where this synthetic security would be issued with tranches, it is needed, in my view, to have a first loss guarantee by the member states to the junior tranche. Otherwise, the junior tranche will not have enough demand. But that would be very important. There can't be a capital markets union without a pan-European safe asset with a risk-free rate or close to a risk-free rate. And so to have a single currency, a banking union, an integrated capital markets would be, I think, an important asset in the new geopolitical situation where Europe needs to project whatever power it can muster. Thank you very much.
Right. Thank you very much, Vítor. You've given us plenty of food for thought, and I know this audience, there are going to be pointed questions coming to you. If you'd like to come over and join us on the test here. While you're coming over, since everybody's now here, I'll remind you of the three sponsors of this event, not just LSE, but the European Institute, which is a very lively program, and the Dahrendorf Forum, which is an initiative looking at the future of Europe under ideas. Look at our work, because it's very important to all of what we're doing. Now, let me start with a very quick question while the audience is thinking of theirs. Great ideas, all very well, but what it boils down to is that the Germans aren't going to pay for it, therefore it isn't going to work.
Well, I don't necessarily agree in this sense. Of the proposals I put forward or endorsed, The only thing that would have an additional cost is the stabilization fund. To have a normal central bank and accept that indeed the ECB should behave as a normal central bank and use all the tools that we have used, so the precedent is created and endorsed by the European Court of Justice, that is not a cost, except in terms of doctrine, but not in financial terms. The stabilization fund, yes, that would entail a cost. But again, if it doesn't happen tomorrow, it's not vital for the present situation. There is no existential crisis ongoing in the euro area right now. So that is an important thing for the future. Yes, it would be important, but of course, monetary union can still wait for that to happen.
Okay, if you accept, we're going to take questions in groups of three.
Sure.
Well, for once, the women are asking first. This is very good. Lady in yellow.
Well, nowadays,
then lady here,
that's
and then down here. Wait for the mic. Say who you are and try to make the question succinct.
Okay, my name's Sienna Parrish. First quick question, will this be online or somewhere? Because that's a lot that's there. The PowerPoint?
Oh, yes, it'll eventually
it will be.
Okay,
yes.
Good. Because my mind's like, there's a lot. Second question, you were talking about in terms of leaving the European Union earlier. I kind of have to bring up Brexit because of that. You were saying it would weaken the currency. The pound has historically been fairly strong. That's why Britain kept it. And one of the largest things I hear outside when talking to people is, oh, once we leave the European Union, the pound will become even stronger. I was just wondering your response to that, because it's kind of hard to just, I don't know, provide a quick response to that when someone says it.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, if you could pass the microphone back to your left. And then next one is going to be down here.
Thank you. Yeah? Yes. Stella Ladi from Queen Mary University. It's a political question, yeah? Because I agree with the chair that the important thing is to see how all can be actually implemented. And you pointed that asymmetry was one of the main fallacies of the design initially. I'm wondering now, after all the programs that the periphery countries have been through, do they have a voice in these reform processes? And or is it just the German-French exchange? And if they have a voice, what are they saying?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Okay, the third question here. No, over here, please.
Walter Schäckle from the European Institute. You started your talk with the two shocks on which I agreed, except for the word shock, namely the interest rate downward convergence and the tsunami of capital flows was totally expectable, endogenous consequences of financial and monetary integration. You end with a capital markets union. In other words, the way forward is more financial integration. While you tell us in between, and that's a variation on Ian's question, that governments are not ready to underwrite a lot of risk.
Yeah.
So I wonder how that goes together, and I would have liked to hear more about what we call now macro prudential, which is capital controls by another name. In other words, we must be ready to segment markets rather to integrate them ever more if governments do not want to underwrite these risks.
It's a very good question, yeah.
We're glad you're flexible, Peter, because these are three very different questions.
Yes.
Please.
Oh, okay. Now, on the first question, well, it's my view, but I think that, of course, the pound was never part of the monetary union. So the question is not related with the problems of the monetary union as such. But it's a question which is a pertinent one. And in my view, of course, the pound will tend to be weaker, of course. We see it already, and in my view, for quite a number of years, growth potential in the UK will be lower than otherwise without Brexit, and that will be, in the end, reflected in the strength of the currency, as it is to be expected if we look to all the historical examples. Now, the periphery and what are they saying? Well, in my view, they are not saying enough, to tell you the truth. Because, if anything, they have not been very vocal in proposing reforms. Officially, there was, as far as I can tell, only a document from the Spanish government. But other governments did not present their own proposals officially. And I think that's a pity. I think they should have done it. They should have done it because that's the moment to have a full discussion about all this. Now that we are in a situation where all countries are growing, all countries have a positive current account balance, all countries have budgets below 3% and all of that, that's the moment to discuss the fundamentals of the monetary union and prepare for stressful situations that will come, of course, we know. Indeed, those countries have not been active in this respect, not even in reacting to the document of the 14 French and Spanish economists. I would have expected, and I expected, indeed, more reaction from economists in several other countries, and it didn't happen. When I left, my last speech was indeed a programmatic sort of speech with recommendations that I more or less repeated here, with underlying more some aspects now that I am out than when I was still the vice president of the ECB. And I intend to continue to, I've been active on Twitter, I will have my blog. I have had no time really to write it, but it's all prepared. So it's important to discuss the ideas, even if we know that at the present moment there is no political will. But it's important that the discussion, the proposals, are put forward because they represent pertinent elements for the discussion. In the end, as it is historical norm, big countries have a more power about what will be decided. That's the way it has been. But at least let's have a deeper discussion, because I think the monetary union needs a jump, a quantum leap in reforms, thinking deeply about what has happened and why it has happened and how this can be avoided in the future. Now, the more difficult question, more financial integration. Well, part of the answer, I mentioned it, is that banking union makes a lot of difference to that. So financial integration initially happened without any banking union. So, I was governor of the Central Bank of Portugal at that time. And as such, member of the governing council, but okay. Member, governor of the central bank, and I could do nothing. There is freedom of capital movements, of course, in the euro area. The monetary union make that easier and more enticing. And markets, there was a huge market failure because at a certain point in time, the Portuguese sovereign debt, 10 years. Was paying 12 basis points more than the German debt. There was markets. Giving markets the control of the situation. That's what happened. And this was mostly, as I said, flows coming from the banks in core countries to banks in the periphery. So a proper banking union that should have been there from the start in the proper design of a monetary union, because monetary union, as I said, was very minimalist design, with the ideas that it would be enough to control inflation
And for that to have a single monetary policy attuned to that objective, and then a fiscal break on, budget in all countries not having huge deficits. And that would be enough for everything work smoothly. That is not enough at all, because indeed finance and debt are essential features of our economies, and they were totally disregarded. By the way, it's also true about the optimum currency area theory, where capital flows are not considered there at all. Of course, at the time, that was more justified because the capital movements were not as important or as free in the 60s when the OCA theory started than they are now. But they are absent there. So the whole concept initially was insufficient. And indeed, banking union makes a difference, because then, of course, the exposures and the concentration of risk of banks in the core would not have happened if there would have been proper supervision and control of that situation. The only thing I could do was to have some pressure and a new regulation on the composition of liquidity of the banks in Portugal, but not about, of course, the capital inflows. And so in that respect, you are absolutely right. Macroprudential tools have to be there and part of the banking union. Indeed, they are, as you know, because in the CRD4, CRR, there are tools of macroprudential policy that can be used to face some potential negative consequences of financial integration. They are not enough. The ECB proposed more, an increase in the tools available for macroprudential policy. That was not accepted. And so the banking package of revision of CRD4, CRR, that is going to be approved in principle, it has been announced until the end of the year, does not expand the set of instruments of macroprudential policy, unfortunately. But that's all part of facing that situation. The Capital Markets Union is, in my view, the following. The more difficult step was to have monetary union and a single currency. Now that exists, well, let's at least try to benefit from the effects of a deep liquid market for all of Europe. When we look to the US, when we look to the European situation, where there are no high-tech firms that are important, in the first 20 firms in the world related to the internet, there is not a single European one. They are either American or Chinese. And part of this, there are no doubt many explanations, is that in Europe, the capital market to have IPOs that can really generate returns for those who risk the capital, that lose money in many projects, because that's part of venture capital activity, but then for the successful projects, deep liquid capital markets provide the returns, and that's important that Europe would have this integration for that purpose. Of course, there is also an element of risk sharing of income. I think that the growth effect would be more important. So,
let's move to a second round. Yes. We'll go upstairs this time. So, right at the top.
Okay. Oh, many questions. Yeah, good.
And then, up there. And then
Thomas Drust, Warsaw School of Economics.
Yeah.
You mentioned that.
Can you speak louder, please?
You mentioned that adjustment efforts made by Greece contributed to the GDP decrease. Was it, however, the case that the reason for the severe GDP decrease was the domestic economic policy led by Greek government? Thank you.
Okay.
And then a second question just here. Yeah. And the third one will be over here.
Mm-mm. Nila, MSc, IPE from LSE. Thank you very much for the presentation. Quick question about the risk-free asset for guaranteeing not euro bonds, but basically the synthetic asset. What would be the main perceived, possibly systemic risks you would identify with the asset, even if it is first and foremost designed to relieve risk situations? Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah.
And then we have a third question here.
Yes, hello. I'm studying my first year of management here. When you were talking about the Stability Pact, actually some countries have been known to not follow the rules, such as France massively, for example. So do you actually believe that it is a good reform, or do you think the rules should be changed or strictly abandoned because it is not anymore a relevant reform for the monetary union?
Ça marche ou ça marche pas?
Okay. Yes, thank you. Well, regarding the Greek adjustment, well, as I said, it was not anticipated by anyone, by the European institutions or by the IMF that designed together the program, that the effects of the program, the first and the second, would be so dramatic as they were. Well, there were mistakes that the IMF recognized with the calculation of the fiscal multipliers. That's technical, and indeed, it was, with insight, it was indeed a mistake. But it's more than that, because what happened, in my view, in the case of Greece, was that the size of the imbalances were huge, huge. And the degree of adjustment led to a sort of collapse of confidence of the economic agents and the population in Greece. And that sort of institutional collapse was not factored in at all, and could not be, perhaps, factored in any calculation. And the Greek economy unraveled in a dimension that no one anticipated or planned for or wished for. That was not the case. No one ever thought that the adjustment would lead to a 25% decrease of GDP. No one. And by the way, all the numbers in the program were showing a mild effect of the adjustment measures. And they were totally wrong. But it went beyond pure objective economic variables. It was a more, a broader societal collapse of confidence, of trust, of everything. So that happened. And it was indeed a major tragedy, because no country ever had such a collapse of economic activity, and with all the consequences and effects afterwards. The risk-free, the synthetic safe asset. Well, there are two possibilities of having a safe asset, in my view. There is the so-called e-bond, which was a proposal in a report prepared by a group chaired by Mario Monti before he was prime minister. It was a report in the beginning of 2011, I presume, or even 2010, to the Commission. And the e-bonds would be based on the following. There would be a public vehicle that would issue securities and would buy the national debt. So the securities would be backed by national debt. But the securities, without tranches, the securities issued by that public vehicle, an European institution, would have preferential treatment over the national debt. Would have a superiority in terms of guarantee. So meaning that they would have to be paid before payment of national debt. So this seniority of those bonds issued by the vehicle would be consequently safer. And a huge amount could be organized in a recent discussion paper of the CEPR by Leandro and Zettelmeier. They make all the calculations showing that by using e-bonds, a target of 25 to 30% of the total European debt could be treated this way and would become safer. There are no absolute safe securities, but it would be safer. Of course, the potential negative point in this is that the national debt that would have continued to be issued, the cost of those that insurance could increase slightly. They make some simulations trying to demonstrate that it would be not very significant, the increase in the cost. So that would be a solution. The other solution is to have a tranched approach. So there would be someone, including the private sector, although difficult, someone would issue these securities based on the national, based on, then backed by the national debt that would be purchased, issuing these securities in two or three tranches. And the senior tranche of that synthetic security would be very safe. And calculating the correlations historically and so on, they are not, of course, totally reliable, as the crisis showed with the CDOs in the US in particular, but nevertheless, the senior tranche would be quite safe. And that would be the safe asset. The problem of that approach is the junior tranche, the part of the issuance that if any accident would happen, any member country would default, the losses would be first in that junior tranche and perhaps only in that junior tranche. And then the problem is who is going to buy that junior tranche. Not only that, what is the economics of the whole thing? Because whoever issues this synthetic security gets the interest payments of the state, of the member states, so as that as the revenue, and then issues its own securities, and to make a profit or not to make losses, as to issue the whole set of tranches at prices that would be such that there would be a difference between the revenue they get from the national member countries and what they would have to pay to the market for the different tranches. And for that, if to place the junior tranche, they would have to pay significantly cost, significantly yield, then the senior tranche would have to be sold as being better than bonds. That's a difficult sell, no question. So there is a problem of the demand for the junior tranche and the problem of the overall economics of the issuance of such a synthetic product. And my proposal is the only way forward to make this viable, and this then could work, would be for member countries to provide a first loss guarantee to the junior tranche. So whenever there would be an accident, there would be a first loss, say, of 10%. I didn't make any precise calculations. There would be a first loss that would be covered by joint liability. It's a contingent liability, and it would not be very, very big, and would make the product viable. And by having that, we would have a European safer asset, which should be useful for several things, to diversify the bank's portfolio, to create a yield curve, a pan-European yield curve, to value assets and all of that. So, okay, that's then the risk-free thing. Finally, the Stability Pact. Well, yes, if we go back to the history of the Stability Pact, we see that several countries, starting with Germany and France in 2003 and 4, that explicitly did not comply with the pact in 2003 and 4. France did not comply for many more years than that. But Germany, during those 2 years. I will not go into details. The thing ended up in court, which could not decide otherwise than accepting the fait accompli.
It was a judgment of Solomon.
Yes, right. That is true and can be invoked by anyone that in the past there has been forbearance. It's very difficult, by the way, for the Commission to achieve compliance from all countries, because what are the sanctions? What are the instruments to impose that? It is to be expected that the countries that approved the rules should comply with the rules. But to have, for instance, which is foreseen in the treaty, as you know, fines that the countries would pay after a certain number of years without correcting the excess, well, really is something that no one expects that it would be used when a country has a higher deficit, now has a fine, and has to pay more to Brussels. So it's very difficult, and that's why, indeed, it's important to have a more flexible and less procyclical and simpler stability pact. And I think that the recent proposal by the French Conseil d'Analyse Économique is a good proposal, because it would be just, the rule would be only about the expenditure path, and the expenditure path excluding unemployment subsidy or increase in taxes that the country would decide to have higher expenditure would increase taxes, and that's okay. That would not be a violation of the expenditure rule. And also, if the unemployment subsidy goes up, then it does not count for the expenditure rule. So all that is corrected, which means that that sort of expenditure rule is less procyclical, because these elements are not counted for the rule. Also, the rule would be devised so that with that expenditure path, in the medium term, a certain objective of debt ratio would be attained. And it's not 60% in the proposal. And that's very wise, because, you know, the 60%, how did it emerge? Well, in the first place, when the Maastricht Treaty was negotiated, it was more or less the average of the euro area debt ratio. Well, simple. And then there was a rationalization. If countries would have a deficit of 3% with a nominal growth, I mean, long term, of 5.3% real growth as the time at the time seemed possible, plus 2% inflation, 5. So with time, in the long term, the debt ratio would converge to 60%, 3 over 5. Well, 3 over 5 doesn't exist anymore nowadays. I mean, the 5 doesn't exist, of course, because we are not going to have year after year after year 3% real growth. We are in the protracted phase of secular stagnation, if you wish, with the demography and all that. And so the 60% has not the same rationale that it had when it was discussed. And no one dares to put this into question. Yes, and now I am putting it also into question. Indeed, this has to be discussed. The wisdom of this also. The other thing is that the situation in Europe is that the current account surplus of the euro area is 3% of GDP. So there is a situation of high savings because of demography, because of the current cohort, which is the bulk of the population in the middle, is saving more. That situation will change in 15 years' time because of the way demography is going. But meanwhile, there is a situation of high savings, which means that there will be a situation of low interest rates. And with low interest rates also, debt sustainability is different from higher rates. So there are all sorts of arguments to think hard about the 60%. And the French proposal allows that, because puts in the objective a discretionary, bespoke, country-by-country objective. And then is less procyclical. And it's just about that. So no structural deficits, it's not in the proposal. The target 1 over 20 reduction of the debt ratio every year, and all that is not in the French proposal. So I think it would be something to really discuss deeply, and I'm very happy that that proposal came to the fore. And there would be indeed a more flexible, less pro-cyclical fiscal rule.
I'm afraid the bad news there is that the British expenditure rule in the 1980s fell apart.
Well,
I'm afraid, audience, yeah, that we've run out of time.
Oh.
But if you allow me one concluding question to you, Vitor, it's this. Look forward 10 years, bring out your crystal ball, uh-huh, and describe in a couple of sentences what you think the euro will be.
You mean the euro area or the euro?
The euro as an entity.
In 15 years?
10 years, 10 years.
10 years. I think it will be there. meaning, I don't anticipate a collapse. One has to think about the following. Several countries went through a process of structural adjustment. Structural. For instance, the analysis both of the ECB and the IMF about the fact that all these countries now have a positive current account surplus, or zero or positive. But in both cases, the ECB and the IMF concur that this is mostly a structural improvement, not a cyclical improvement, not just the result of, say, import compression. No, it's a structural change. Calculating the cyclically adjusted current account deficits, that is shown. So, and I can tell you from my country that I know best, there has been a significant change in the structure of production over, say, the past 15 years. It's not something of the more recent years, but it's been ongoing. So, and these countries now have this positive current account surplus and are competitive, as I try to show with those charts about exports behavior and so on, are competitive with the present level of the exchange rate of the euro. So this is a potential indication that indeed the whole construction can work. The vulnerability of the present situation is the fact that several of these countries still have a high debt ratio. That's the vulnerability. But not so much the real economy adjustment in a situation that would be similar to the present one in terms of the euro exchange rate. So this is an indication that this can indeed work. Now, there are particular problems with some countries, as I also showed there. Greece is on demand after a tragic episode, but it's on demand. Let's hope that it continues. Italy is a structural problem. I mean, the economy. I'm referring to the real economy, to the real economy of Italy, because Italy, after the war, had incredible good decades of innovation and growth and creation of new products and so on. And then, 20 years ago, everything stopped. Productivity growth in Italy for 20 years has grown very little. So there is a structural problem there. It's not the euro. And the idea that a country could live at its own currency and devalue, well, in the first place, any country that would live in a weak position would have a very weak own currency, subject to continuous attacks, collapses in the market. Not as bad as Argentina or Turkey, but, you know, very much under pressure with all the instability that creates. The effects of immediate gain in competitiveness are short-lived because the import prices would go up and so inflation would come back, and then you need again. It's not a way to really address the structural problems of a country. So it's not a solution for countries like Italy, and let alone the fact that with a weak currency, that would be, very weak. The debt that Italy has to foreigners in euros would have to be satisfied, or the country would have a major default with all the consequences of that for access to markets during many years. So the idea that countries with the structural problems could find a solution by having the exchange rate is indeed wrong. And as I said, the Hawke theory gives too much importance to the role of the exchange rate, which is not nowadays as true as perhaps it was when the Hawke theory was conceived.
I think that's a very positive note on which to end.
Yeah.
Okay. So in my best Portuguese, obrigado.